This was a Castaway Media production. Find more great podcasts on our network. Visit castaway.media.
Hello and welcome to episode 44 of Pataroni. And this week we're talking to PJ Gallagher. But before PJ Gallagher, I have my friend here, Kieran Dunleavy here. How are you, Kieran?
How you doing, Joe? How are you?
And we're sitting here enjoying a couple of bottles of Jack Cody beer. If you're going to listen to that there, that is it. Beautiful stuff. Mm-hmm. I have a bottle of amber ale.
And I have a bottle of Hibernicus. It's a dry hopped IPA.
It's brilliant. Like, Jack Cody is the brewery based in Drogheda. And it's delicious stuff. Real hoppy kind of taste off this one, anyway. And it's kind of no bubbles. You know what I mean? It's a natural kind of beer.
Mine's a kind of a wintry one, I think.
Yeah?
Mm. It's kind of, it's quite full. It's 5.2. Yeah.
4.8 here. Mm. It's got malted barley, hops, yeast, boyne water.
Mm-hmm.
From the boyne and a pinch of crack. Now, if you're listening outside Ireland, it's crack, spelled C-R-A-I-C, which is...
fun.
Fun, not drugs. So, Kieran, you're running a festival out in Innishear this July. 15th to 17th July.
It is indeed,
yeah. Craggy Island Festival. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, it's the first year running it on the original island. You see, it's the start of Father Ted, the one with the shipwreck, and it kicks off Friday evening when you get out on the boat. There's two boats, one from Doyle and one from Rossaville, or you can get Air Aran, which is a plane flight 30 minutes from Galway.
Yeah, so it's the original island, the craggy island that was you see at the beginning of Father Ted.
Yeah, they're zooming in, and then when they're zooming in the island, you see more of the island, and it zooms in the house, which is actually in Clare.
Oh yeah, the actual house in Clare, but the shipwreck that you see is on Innishear, where this festival is. Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's called the Plassey.
Oh, that's called a Plassey.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool, cool.
She's on Facebook as well.
All right, yeah. Oh, the ship actually has a Facebook page.
Yeah, I'm friends with her.
And so the festival's run from the Friday to the Sunday, and there's all the Father Ted crack, which is there'll be myself,
mm-hmm.
who is, you know, Father Damo, obviously. Michael Redmond, who's Father
Stone.
Mm-hmm. And
Owen McGlove. It's Patrick McDonald, who was Owen McGlove on Father Ted. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've three original characters coming out. Friday night. I think your ticket entitles you to one of three stand-up gigs, because we can only sit 100 in the Arts Centre or a Sainer.
Yeah.
So Friday night is on Clove and Father Stone, and Saturday night you're going to do a double show with Father Stone and yourself.
So, yeah.
So everyone gets into one night of live stand-up, and then there's different things on each night in the three bars, and then after that, each event will lead everybody down to the Franzini brothers have a circus tent coming out, which can easily have 300 plus standing for live gigs and DJs, which will run on quite late.
And Father Stone is doing some crazy golf.
Mm.
Is it the first 20 people who get tickets, or 40?
30 or 40.
30, 40.
Yeah, we'll have to cap it. It's ticket sales only started a couple of weeks ago, but they're already starting to sell.
Yeah.
So the first batch.
And it's on. Go ahead. What's the website? www.craggyisland.com.
Festival.com.
Festival.com.
CraggyIslandFestival.com.
And so the first 30 or
30 or 40 will get to play crazy golf with Father Stone.
Mm.
So I think that's going to be brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. And he said himself it's a dream come true, because he always wanted his own golf academy.
Right, yeah, cool.
So yeah, it's good crack.
So there's a load of Father Ted like stuff. There's obviously lovely girls.
That'll be Saturday night.
Saturday night, Golden Cleric, is that correct? Is there a priest?
Yeah, we'll have hopefully a Golden Cleric award, which will run into probably Sunday for people who are best dressed and best crack over the weekend. So
yeah.
We'll have a couple of people getting spot prizes and all sorts of things. So that'll be good fun Sunday.
There's a treasure hunt for
Saturday morning. Yeah,
Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whistle will have gone missing, so we can't start the sports day, so we have to go around to John and Mary's shop to find out, to get our treasure map. And it's kind of family friendly as well, because it'll be earlier, I think Saturday morning. So we'll eventually find where the whistle is, and then we get the fun and games going on the beach. We'll have Funland, the theme park, and then we'll have the likes of Trina Sack race, egg and spooning race.
Spooning as in you'll getting, be spooned.
Getting spooned.
While running with an egg.
While being the spoonie.
Yeah, okay. binocular soccer sounds good to me.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the highlights, yeah. The ball will be either very near or very far away.
You'll have binoculars attached to your eyes. So
to your eyes, so you can't tell where the ball is, really. So it's to recreate that over 75 soccer match. So that was John Cuskey, the DJ who's playing Friday, Saturday and Sunday. He'll be on each night after the bands. He came up with that idea.
Yeah, right, cool.
Yeah, he's brilliant. He's come out with some really good ideas to throw towards the festival. Everyone has so far. Like, it's a lot of people involved, really.
Yeah, and you brought me out to the island, and the whole the people on the island, the guys who run the pubs and all, are all behind this. So it's going to be good bit of crack.
Yeah, everyone on the island is just really looking forward to it and really looking forward to getting people out. And among all the crack and that, it's an absolutely stunning place anyway. So
yeah, and the music is going to be good too. I think, like, because you've got your Father Ted thing, but you've got some great bands playing.
Yeah, there's local musicians on the island. They'll be on first each night. Friday night we'll have Grand. They're a band from the kind of New Orleans Django Reinhardt type.
With really brass.
Yeah, brass, double bass, all that kind of really. They're going to really get the place going. And then headlining Friday night we've got Road Angel. They're a band from Dublin and Sligo. And they're going to do the likes of your AC/DC, and they're going to really do classic rock songs. Excellent. And really get the tent jumping, you know. So looking forward to that. Saturday night, it's your son's band.
Oh yeah, my son's band are playing, yeah.
Rogue Generator.
Yeah.
Then your band.
And then the band I'm in is called The Afters. We're doing like kind of 90s stuff, like Depeche Mode, The Cure, Gary Numan, Human League, ska stuff, specials. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff. Obviously, we'll have to do. We will do Ghost Town.
Yeah.
And
National Anthem.
Yeah. So it's, and
it's Sunday night then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Robbed and Lynched. They're another band from Drogheda. They do kind of Dubliners type pogues. It's all banjos and bits and pieces, fiddles and all that kind of thing. So that's going to be really good. And then our headline act, which I absolutely love their name, is the Cardinal Sins. A band from Tullamore. They're just back from Denmark and Germany, and they're going to do real trad rock, like Shipping Up to Boston and the Pogues, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So they're going to take the roof off the tent Sunday
night. I can't wait for it, actually. It's going to be fucking great crack. God, I'm liking this beer, though. The nice Sunday evening kind of.
Yeah, it's taking the edge off the weekend, all right.
Oh, it's delish.
Yeah. Definitely very good now.
So I'm looking forward to that, and that'll be great crack. And Jack Cody's going to be sponsoring my I've got a monthly comedy night in Drogheda. Sorry, getting a bit distracted here. In Odd Molly's, and the first 10 people will get a free Jack Cody. And also the live podcast, there'll be the first 40 people will get a free bottle of Jack Cody's beer. And so anyway, listen to PJ Gallagher. See you on the other side. Thanks, Kieran.
No problem. Cheers.
Producing this podcast. Hang on, I'll just check because headphones. Yes, say hello there.
Hello.
Yeah, you're there. Yeah.
Hello, Joe.
Hi, PJ. Thanks for coming in.
No worries. Thanks a million for having us, I suppose.
No.
You know what I mean? It would have been a day. I apologise again for the state of me. I genuinely do. I'm in an office day.
Oh, no, that's grand. No, yeah. I think you'll reveal more in this state.
I probably will, yeah.
Delicate.
Yeah, I'm delicate.
I can bully you.
I'll probably get all cantankerous now in a while and start saying shit I'll regret later and everything, yeah.
But yeah, and the tabloids will be all over it. That's what happens to some of them. You know, somebody says something and then tabloids
That's happened to me, actually. Anyway.
It happened to you?
Yeah, because I was on an Irishman Abroad, and I just talked about years ago when I was 25 having panic attacks when the ban broke up.
I actually
and
read that. Coffee.
And then, but in the paper it looks worse because it goes, Joe Rooney talks about his struggles with mental illness. Do you know what I mean? But that kind of looks worse.
So it's out of context straight away.
It's out of context because it was only a tiny bit. But then, mind you, I went on Tuberty and started crying. Anyway,
I did. I started crying.
Just in a bad place. Oh,
that's the horrible thing about radio, though, as well, is that you went on there and you started crying, and you know that there's people behind the glass thing, and they're delighted. They're like, "Oh, this is
I know,
great radio." Like, it's just,
I know it's terrible because I think basically what happened is like a relationship broke up, and I had to get out of the house, and. And then it was very complicated, and I was just in a bad place anyway. And then when the researcher was this is all about me now. Sorry, PJ.
no, I'm enjoying this.
When the researcher rang up, you know the way the researchers ring up and they ask you loads of questions. They go, "Why did you have panic attack?" And I go, "Whatever."
Yeah.
And it turns out I should have been going to see a counsellor, but the researcher was becoming my counsellor. So basically, when I went into Tuberty, I was still in that mode, and basically, I was really going into a counselling session. I didn't realise I was on radio.
Just a lot of people listening.
Yeah. And everybody was really nice, but some people go, "Well done on Tuberty," and then I think, I didn't go on there like to do publicity. Do you know? It almost feels like. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I did great, didn't I?
Yeah,
it was brilliant. The crying was brilliant, wasn't it?
Yeah, very brave. Very brave.
And then now I listen to Tuberty and there's people on who've had terrible things happen to them and they're not crying. And I went on crying. And I just feel terrible.
It wasn't fresh for them. They've probably done all the therapy before they got to the
No, I think it is fresh for them. They're going to be crying in a couple of years. It hasn't hit those people. Anyway, yeah. So what was I going to say? Oh, do you have a podcast? Because you said you were...
Dublin podcast. I don't... Yeah. It's me and Suzanne Kane, the two of us do a podcast together. And I love doing it. I love being able to finally have something where you don't have to watch what you do at all.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can say anything you want and just let it go and see where it goes. I knew that I couldn't do one like you do that takes work, like having guests and stuff. I knew that if I started that, I'd do five or six. I'd interview all my friends.
Then I'd get to a stage
where I go, "Oh, this is just not what I wanted it to be." Because I'm a lazy who are really underneath it all.
And it's not that much. Well, it's not that much work. But the thing is, I don't get paid for it, so it feels more.
Yeah, we don't get paid either. But there is something nice about it, isn't there?
There's something lovely
about just, I don't know what it is. Sometimes I go in, sometimes I listen back and I can tell exactly the humour I was in, you know.
Yeah,
sometimes it's just crankiness. It's an hour of just ranting and raving and I'm like a cantankerous old shit
that just needs
to get a shit together. And then I listen back to it and sometimes I'm in a good mood and I'll cheer myself up, you know.
Listening to your own podcast.
I was in a great form that day.
I sort
of get that feeling comes back again. But I don't know what it is. It's the most enjoyable thing I think I've done because unlike stand-up, you know, there's no real direct audience. There's no pressure. Unlike doing other radio work that I'm doing, like there's nobody looking over your shoulder.
I just
something really refreshing about it.
There's no ad break coming up to stop it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Because you're on a roll sometimes on the radio and then, sorry, we have to go for a break.
And there's no rules about having Lionel Richie on before the 9 o'clock news. There's nothing. It's just you doing what you want to do. And because of that, I think when you get feedback from a podcast, it's genuinely the most exciting feedback you get.
Yeah.
So people see on TV or hear on radio or whatever and it's like, "Oh, I love the show." It's great. It's nice. It's great that people give. But there's something about someone that's gone to the effort of finding your podcast, downloading it, and then approaching you and saying, "Oh, I really liked what you were saying." It's something that gives you a buzz again. It's kind of like the beginnings of stand-up. You know that feeling when you were doing rooms and there was like nobody in it? And then somewhere out of nowhere, you might be just like looking at a pair of shoes in the shop and someone go, "Is that your gig the other night?" And it gives you a real sort of a buzz, you know?
Oh, yeah, because you were just doing it for the crack.
Yeah, because you're doing exactly.
And then someone recognised you.
And then all of a sudden, Jesus, somebody's actually listening.
I like it doing that, because I found that there's people that I've known for years, probably like yourself, and I'm finding out stuff about them. It's really weird, actually. So it's very, I don't know, it's fine.
It's weird though as well. I say it's great for you because How much do you actually know about people? You know, you meet people for years and years and years,
you
and
don't,
then
like
they could be doing anything. They could be up to anything. You wouldn't know really what people are doing. Even my best mates sometimes. One of my best mates, it's like Chandler from Friends. I couldn't tell you what he does for a living, and that's where he spends like 60% of his life.
That's a blokey thing, isn't it? You meet your blokey mates and then, but you never actually talk about, you just talk about the match or whatever.
Yeah, but that's what's refreshing about it. That's why when you're with someone and like, how was Mick? I don't know. You're with him for the whole day.
What
did you just talk about? I don't know. Nothing. Yeah. Pretty much nothing. Like, it's almost like a
You were just messing and making each other laugh.
Yeah, just talking shit. Yeah. Just making each other laugh. Being morons. Being a pair of morons enjoying time together.
Yeah,
I think that's probably how lads... It's good for our health, I think, to do that. To actually not talk about shit.
I think so. That's the way we are. Like, I remember when my son Danny was a toddler. He was about nearly two, and I brought him to. Was actually made bring him to a parent toddler group. I was made do it because I knew it wasn't going to be parent toddler. It was going to be mother toddler.
Oh yeah,
I was the only man there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And all the women could talk about their kids for hours. Like, and they go and they ask me questions like, so what age was your fellow when he started walking? I don't fucking know. I can't remember. I know he's walking now, and well, at one point he wasn't walking.
Yeah, so I don't know what age he is now.
Everything about their kids.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he was 8 months and 2 days he started walking. You know, they know.
Yeah, because it's practiced information. They've had this story. They've sold this a few times. It's in their head.
Yeah, I know.
You know, the day it happened, they said it's someone that you, whereas you were like, oh, Jesus, look at him.
Yeah.
When did he start doing that?
Yeah, yeah.
Has he always been reading?
Oh, Jesus. It was terrible. It was a terrible experience. Anyway, I'd go see a counsellor for that. Anyway, did you grow up in Wahine, PJ?
No, in Marino.
Good, my research is brilliant.
Marino, and then later Clontarf. So Wahine was kind of Shelbyville for us. It was there. That was the other side of the tracks altogether.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Just something about it was like, it's kind of like an Irish-English thing. We didn't like anyone in Wahine, and they couldn't give a shit about us at all. We were just like terrible friends to them or something.
Rahini's posh, is it?
It's kind of a bit of both. It's a bit of everything. It's its own sort of micro... sort of country in Rahini, really.
Right, yeah.
But Marino first.
North side and south side of Rahini, even.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, typical Dublin,
yeah.
So, Marino, it's funny being from Marino because Clontarf people would sort of look at you and say, you're a knacker, but then everyone that's living right beside you says you're posh. So you really are stuck right in the middle. Like, you're it's a weird one. Like, I remember being...
Clontarf is posh, right?
Because Clontarf is, posh north side, I'd say,
Yeah.
And then it sort of... I suppose it goes down the scale then. Then it goes Marino, and then you're kind of in town.
Right, yeah.
But I love it there. I'm back there now, and I just love it. Yeah. I don't know what it is about the place. It's just...
Where is it exactly, Marino? It's,
you know, Fairview Park?
Yeah.
It's pretty much everything behind Fairview Park.
Towards town or away from town.
So if you're in the park and you're... Looking at the shops, everything behind those shops, that's all Marino.
Oh, there. Back there.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And I do love it there. I love it there. Like, and then moved to Clontarf. Oh, sorry, you're dropping shit. But then I moved to Clontarf and it was just the maddest existence ever because me folks were mental for a start.
Yeah.
Drinkers and all of that crack. Yeah. And then there were 6 mental patients lived in our house. So my old man, he lost his pub, right? Which was in Marino. And then they sort of, whatever money they had left, they bought this house in Clontarf and it was a mental home. So I grew up in an actual mental home. So there was 6 mental patients from the Eastern Health Board, as it was at the time. And my mother was kind of the nurse that was supposed to look after them.
So honey, you're saying your father just bought a mental home with the patients in it?
He bought a normal house.
And then
my mother had to go back to work because he had lost the pub.
Oh, sorry, they weren't in the house.
No, we didn't acquire them, but they didn't come as, you know, like there's a 3-piece suite.
It's a lovely house, but one draw, there's 6 mental patients in
fully
it.
Fully fitted kitchen, gas fired central heating, and 6 mentlers.
That's what I thought.
He comes with a big discount, obviously. Funny enough, it's been on the market for months. You can't get rid of it. So that was, yeah. So it was a weirdest
thing. Like woodlice or something. Mentlers in the house. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
You probably shouldn't say mentlers, but that's always how we referred to them as kids as well. The mentlers.
Really?
Which is terrible, isn't it? Terrible.
Yeah, it is, yeah. But so your mother was a psychiatric nurse.
Yeah, but this is
that right?
She it was such a weird setup. So she was a regular nurse, but then after my old man lost the pub, then she sort of just, I don't even know how she got into it, but I just remember being told there's people coming to live with us. And she was from the Eastern Health Board, and then these guys just started arriving. Six of them came in. And it was the most, and so they were on one half of the house, and we were on the other half, but there was no dividing wall.
All right, so they could wander in.
So it was just, and to me then, I suppose I was very young, and it never really struck me how odd that was.
What age were you then? Were you?
Maybe 10 or 11, maybe about 11, maybe.
And had you have you brothers and sisters?
I've one sister, yeah.
Cause she's younger?
Well, she's younger. But then I was adopted as well, so I have four other that I only met the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, yeah.
But it never
growing up, you were just you and
just
your sister.
Just me and my sister, and then, my mum, my dad, and then...
And then suddenly these six...
And then the six lads. Yeah.
And what kind of mental illnesses?
I think, to be honest, that they would have been people that back in the day, if it was now, they probably had a nervous breakdown and they could have been treated. But back in the day, they just put you into a place and left you there. So I think they were kind of just institutionalised people that didn't know how to look after themselves and never were going to learn how to look after themselves. And then there was one guy, Francis, for instance. He was just convinced that everybody was following him all the time. How this man crossed the road, I have no idea. Like, it used to take him half an hour just to get out of the house because he was sure we were all looking at him. And I suppose because he thought that, then we did end up looking at him. You know, so he was like constantly looking, just like doing this dodging around corners all the time. He drove himself like mad and
paranoid, like, kind of.
Yeah, very paranoid. Yeah, and then there was one guy. He had like delusions, you know. So I remember Jason Bourne coming into the house, and he just never seen that like it. And Little Joe, one of them, his name was Little Joe, and he went straight up to Jason and says, "Can you see them gorillas there? Can you?" And Jason just went, "They'll be gone now in a minute." That's all he said. "They'll be gone in a minute."
Jesus.
Yeah. So it was kind of, but it wasn't like they were all.
This is amazing, PJ. Like, this is it's the best sitcom ever written. Like, what I mean? It could be amazing.
I know. Jason Bourne wanted to write a sitcom on it and everything. I was like, well, do whatever you want to do. But it's kind of, the thing is, it's actually not very believable.
Yeah.
Like, when you think about it, you look at it, you'd say, no, it's not a realistic situation, you know? Even though saying it, it's kind of like, I'd wonder if it happened. But I know it did, like, because it was there.
I mean, it's basically like growing up in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah. Very much like that, yeah. Very much like that. So it was kind of, it was mad, you know. It was mad to end up in that because, as well, I was adopted, like I was saying to you. So of all the situations you find yourself in, it was a pretty unusual one, you know.
Would there not be any kind of regulation if you are going to adopt a child that you can't bring them into a house with six mental patients?
Well, I suppose I was 11 or whatever, so they weren't around.
So there's no one checking.
My dad was a publican at the time, and my ma would have been working in the pub as well.
Sorry, when you were adopted, so you were just a baby,
So when I was adopted, which is another mad thing, because I was delivered to the pub because my parents were at work. So when it was finally brought to my parents, they dropped me off at the pub. Which I always think is mad, because I know my dad, like, I know him. So he would have definitely says, "Are you coming in for the pint?" Like, you know, to whoever dropped the baby off.
Yeah.
I never stop sort of imagining how that conversation would have gone. Now I can't, like, I'm delivering kids. My dad, "All right, well, suit yourself," you know.
Right, he'd be like that.
Yeah, so I suppose the first time I ever met me folks was in their pub in Marino, yeah.
And was that there? That was their pub? Like, that was a family pub?
Yeah, it was my dad's pub beforehand. Yeah. So it's Granger's pub on the Malahide Road now. It used to be Gallagher's, obviously, but that's the White House, it was called.
And you're saying your parents were drinkers?
Yeah. Oh, a big history of drinking in the house, yeah. Like, my poor old man, like, he looked, Jesus Christ, I don't know, he looked about 20 years older than what age he was. Just that typical Dublin man thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I have a picture. I was talking about this in the Separated Birth show I did with Joanne McNally. I have a picture of me old man and me. And I don't... Like, we're on a beach, on Dollymount Beach. And he's, I'm in my nip, except for a couple of armbands, because you could be in your nip when you were in the 80s and no one gave a shit when you were a kid. You were just kids were in the nip.
I know.
And armbands weren't considered dangerous in the sea.
No.
Someone in.
I know, it's brilliant.
You know, I remember queuing up for an ice cream van in the nip. Like, it just was so different. And my dad's standing next to me, and he's got a comb over and a cigarette and a full suit standing on the beach. And he's 28. Like, he's about 28 years old. He's a young man, and he looks fucked. Like, he looks absolutely wrecked. He really does, like. And I look at that now, and I think, what happened to that man? Like, what happened to him? Like, he was just knackered. I think he just had, you know, there's a way of doing life, and you know, you go to work, you have a few drinks, you have a couple of kids, and you wear a suit on the beach, and that's life. And that's what you do. That's what everybody does. And I think he did his best, to be honest, because he's a good lad, but he wasn't really... Like, the world kicked the shit out of him, you know? Yeah. He wasn't... He was a very soft sort of a fella, really, you know? I remember once just lying in bed, and he came into me room, and he just comes in out of nowhere and just goes, fucking hard, isn't it? And I was like, what is? He goes, life, like... It's just... And I started laughing, you know? And then you just see him going, and he walked out. And I remember thinking...
Crying.
No, just like, like just angry.
Oh, just
like,
kind of,
Jesus, you know. Yeah. And he walked off, and I just remember thinking, it really stuck at me. It's just because it reminds you there's a human being in there, you know. You forget sometimes there's a human being. You see your folks, and they're just two people who won't let you do all the shit you want to do. And then, and that for one reason, for some reason, that's a really fond memory I have of me old man.
It's amazing.
Talk to you.
No, same like yes. Yeah. And the whole suit, it was a thing. I suppose if you didn't, still, I mean, this was the 80s you're talking about. It was the 60s, happened a long time ago when young people did. But anyway, he wasn't part of that revolution in the 80s.
Yeah. No.
Because I'm just saying, my father would have been a lot older than your father, but and he was a farmer, but he would wear a suit out milking cows as well. It was a thing that men just wore suits.
Just, and I remember even road workers back then, corporation workers. There'd be lads wearing actual gear for work, and there'd be one old lad carrying a bucket in a suit jacket.
And a tie.
And a tie in the whole lot. And he'd be like, what? Like, I don't, it's weird when you think of it.
It is weird,
But then, you know, I was looking at the 1916 stuff all this week for, you know, there's a photographic exhibition in the Meeting House Square there. And I went to look at it. And it must be a kickback from those times because there's lads cleaning up the rubble in 1916 and they're in flat caps and suits. Like,
yeah.
So maybe that was just how you went to work, regardless of what you did, and maybe that's those lads were a throwback from then.
But you see, I don't think there was any fashion as such. You just wore what your parents wore.
Yeah.
When did fashion came in the 50s or something? But it might not have reached Ireland, you know. Men wore suits.
Yeah, men wore suits.
And women wore big flowery frocks.
And I think your hat just
determined. And then I think women, when they get to a certain age, cut off all their hair. Do you know when women have that just... don't give a shit anymore. They just have kind of just a short hair.
You just cut it and then it was like they stuck a banger in it and just let it go.
And dyed it some ridiculous colour like purple or plum or something. So you were you went to school there in where?
I went to school in Raheny. In St. Paul's in Raheny. Yeah, I went to school in Raheny.
Yeah, that's it,
And I hated it. I never had a good day in school. Not one single good day in any school.
Really?
Yeah, I hated it. I couldn't wait. Like, I was that one kid that as soon as I'm 16, I'm walking out of here. I was that kid.
Yeah.
And I pretty much did.
And no, like, so no college that just...
No. Yeah. Went to, like, acting school many years later.
Oh, yeah.
I was 16 and I remember I had this ridiculous fringe. Like, it was that sort of psychobilly look was in at the time. Yeah. You know that? So I had like a shaved head and this ridiculous fringe. But my hair is curly, so it turned into these like dreadlocks that the lads used to call shit sticks.
Oh, right.
So I had the shit sticks like down over my eyes. And one of our teachers said to cut it. And I cut it just above my eyes. And he said, no, cut them off completely. And for some reason, that was the last straw. That was it. I said, you know something? You can fuck off. And then I couldn't stop myself and I went around to all my teachers like, you can fuck off and you can fuck off and you can fuck off. And me form master Skippy, he wasn't in. Skippy. And I waited in his office. And he came in and says, what are you doing here? He says, see you, you can fuck off. And that was it. I never went back.
Well, there's a certain determination there, isn't it?
Yeah, there
like
really
you definitely
was.
Are burning every single bridge.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
you're
yeah.
waiting around for the bridge to arrive.
Yeah, I was doing so the David McSavage on it. I
yeah,
wanted to make
total
sure they never have me back.
Yeah. That's total. No, it's total.
But to this day, it was the best thing that I ever did. Mm. It was the best thing I ever did. Because then after that happened, like it was the usual, I went home. My ma says, no, you're going back to school. And then realises, okay, you're not going back to school.
Mm.
Went in to do this sort of sound and lighting training course thing that was only 3 months in Temple Bar. And then, so by the end of that year, I met Jason Bourne working in the warehouse. And if that hadn't happened, then I don't know what I'd be doing. I literally don't know what I'd be doing.
Yeah.
Because Jason Bourne's probably the most influential person that I've met in my life, you know.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have a clue. So it was the best thing that ever happened. I walked in and there was Jason, who looked like exactly like Tintin and Fido Dido at the time.
Yeah.
Working, fixing lights, and just hit it off with him, like straight away. So and that warehouse, I actually remember as being probably the best time in my life, those 4 years in that warehouse.
Because I've heard loads of stories that you'd have something like Hat Day or something.
Everything. We had to end up doing entertainment because that was my first job. And it wasn't a real job. Like we could do anything we wanted. We weren't cut out for the real world to have him work there ever again.
Yeah.
Because like you just go in one day and we'd say, right, it's hat day, so no one's working. We spent the whole day making hats out of the raw materials we were supposed to use to make lights.
Yeah.
Or then another day, one day we just painted ourselves black. Other days we got Jason Bourne, we crucified him. Built a big truss, a big cross out of like the scaffolds that we hung the lights on, yeah. And just hung him on it for the day.
You hung him on it for the day?
Yeah, and then other days at random, because I was the young guy, I was only 16, walking around the warehouse. At random, then people get bored and they just tie me up and throw me in the skip. They tied me to lampposts up and down Camden Street.
Yeah.
And they'd leave you there. Like, I remember the guards coming, what's going on? And then I told them, and the guards thought it was so funny, they just left me there as well.
Really?
Yeah, just left me there.
Okay, yeah.
Because they could see the other lads laughing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, like, there was a TV downstairs. Oh, no, there was a wall downstairs with a TV spray painted on it and a little couch. And a guy with a Steve Ryan and Owen that used to work there would just drink in the basement. It wasn't a real job. It was
brilliant.
Impossible to get fired, no matter what you did. It was I think I broke my shoulder and didn't come in for like 4 months. And everybody knew. Like, no one gave a shit. It was unbelievable. It was weird, but it was fantastic.
That's amazing. So it's a light and sound rental place.
Just lighting. Yeah, yeah.
Lighting rental place.
Yeah. And it was just such a brilliant thing to be a teenager.
Who was employing you that was so fucking brilliant to not give a shit?
Yeah, it was called Lighting Dimensions. It was run by an English company called White Light.
Yeah.
They sent us a new manager. This is the thing. They sent us, because we weren't very productive, so they sent us a new manager over from White Light England, and he was going to come and change the whole thing.
Yeah.
Richard was his name. And he arrived and starts giving us a couple of orders, and we tied him up, put him in a flight case box. Right? And had him delivered by courier to the Olympia Theatre. And then, you know, they opened up in the Olympia and, of course, they wouldn't sign for him, I suppose. But the courier got the fright of his life when he realised there was a person.
Yeah.
You know, it's only a 10-minute journey or whatever, but he untied him and, like, the courier pulls up outside with our manager sitting beside him in the passenger seat going, not impressed, guys. Really not impressed. It was mental. When I think of it now, it was absolutely mental.
That is class.
But it was the best thing ever. I was 16 years old, and you're getting to see James Brown gigs, and you're like working on all these big names. Even though you're not there, you're in the warehouse, just seeing their name on a piece of paper and throwing cable in the box. That's what I did. I was working on cable, so I was just like making loads and loads of cable all day long. And it was just brilliant. It was just so brilliant. Like, I just remember it so fondly. Everybody, I got on with everyone so well. And it was in Long Lane, just opposite where the Mead Hospital is. And, like, every day, every time I walk up there, I just get that banging nostalgia. Even though the warehouse is long gone now, it's houses and stuff now. It was just great. Just such a great time.
There's definitely something to be said for working a job where you really can do anything you like. It's your
first bit of sort of independence as well. You know, I was making money when all my mates were still in school.
Yeah.
And that felt good. You know, just... I just, yeah, it was just...
No, I've never been in a job. Well, I've been... I worked in Max Records in George's Arcade and had an attitude, all right. So people asked, can I listen to this? I go, no, it's shit. and that's how I ended up in a band, because they asked me to be in the band because they liked my attitude.
Oh, really?
They asked me, would I sing in the band? Never heard me sing. But what you did was unbelievable. That's amazing.
It was great.
And is that how, like from there, did Jason start doing stand-up? Or yeah. Was it when you were working with him?
Yeah, no, Jason was always talking about wanting to do stand-up. Always talked about it. Mm. And to be honest, I didn't even know what it was. I really didn't know what it was. Yeah. I knew there was Billy Connolly and Brendan Grace.
Yeah.
And then a few others my dad listened to. Mm. Can't even remember their names. But they were real old style, you know, lads with suits and...
Yeah.
Mother-in-law jokes and all that crack. Yeah. I didn't know what it was. So when Jason said he wanted to do it, I was like, yeah, whatever. Like,
yeah.
That's a mad thing to want to do.
Yeah.
You know, and then straight away, and then we went to do his first gig.
Because he was, from the beginning, he was like...
Brilliant. From the start.
Yeah, there was no warming up period there.
Yeah, but I remember him at the start and he didn't know really what to do either. You don't know what to do. So we went to buy him some funny clothes.
For his first gig. Really, yeah.
And we went down to the Eager Beaver in Temple Bar to try and find the funniest clothes we could find. But we just ended up finding really normal old clothes. Now that I remember it, yeah. And he went on and did his thing. And it was before a local band, the Coltranes, I think they were called. I think Brent Berry was in that band.
All right, yeah.
And he
went on before them. That was his first gig.
And that was his first gig.
Comedy. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was unusual because it was Jason and no one knew what to expect.
Yeah.
But he did it, you know, and it happened. And then all of a sudden he was saying, let's just do sketches.
Yeah.
And I was like, whatever. Yeah. This seems like a laugh. Why not? And we started doing these. Now, when I think of them now, they were terrible sketches. Jesus, they were bad. But again, it was the start of something. And then I remember meeting all you guys and going into the International the first time. And I think the first time I was ever in the International blew my mind.
Yeah.
I remember sitting there and watching you. I think it was Barry Murphy was the first act I ever saw. And then the Fat Man's Picnic Basket.
Mm.
And they were on.
That's Ian Coppinger and... Paddy, yes.
I can't remember anyway, a second
name. Ian and Paddy. Yeah.
But I remember thinking then, oh, I'll never be able to do this. Never be able to do this. Never. I was around comedy for a long time before I ever did a gig.
But I just wanted to do the sketches. You came on with Jay. I saw you coming on with Jason and you used to put elastic bands around your head.
Yes. Yeah,
so that's all you did. You didn't say anything. It was fucking hilarious, though. It was so funny.
Was it?
It was fucking really funny because you didn't say anything. You looked kind of like gormless or something.
You looked like an idiot. Yeah.
Yeah. And then was it Jason just put the elastic bands on your head? Or did you do it?
Jason used to bring me on and then I'd do one rubber band and then.
Oh, did you say something? Okay. I remember you not saying that. But yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah, well, maybe I don't know. It's so long ago.
Yeah, maybe, whatever. But
and then it would end up with just loads and loads of bands over my face.
Fucking brilliant. It's amazing.
You could never do it now. You never walk into a club now and get away with that shit. That was what was great about that time. It was so experimental.
Do you not think that would work now? I think it would.
I don't think so.
No?
I don't think so. I really don't see where you'd get away with it.
Because I miss that kind of shit, mad shit like that. And like, were you with Jason when he did the stuff with the sheet and the legs?
Yeah. Our magic trick, yeah.
Yeah.
We had loads of scenes. That was a good one, though. Brilliant. That was a good one. The magic show I really enjoyed. Because it was... so deliberately shit. Everybody knew what we were doing and it was as if the two of us were mortified by going wrong. I love doing that. That's actually something I'd love to do with him again.
That was brilliant. I can't remember exactly, but he held up a sheet and he had some fake legs with shoes on them.
It was two sweeping brushes with a pair of runners on the end.
Oh, right.
So the runners didn't even match the runners I was wearing when I walked onto the stage.
The
trousers were a different colour and everything. And then as soon as I'd sit down, he'd come over with the sweeping brushes and stay, and it was like hidden in the sheet.
Yeah.
But you could see it. Like everyone, and he's putting it to me, okay, just fucking hold that there. And I'm like, I'm trying to do, you know. And then I've never met you before in my life, have I? And I would do my weird shake. And then you do the hobbit, 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 making that noise and wiggling his fingers.
That's the magic noise.
Yeah, the magic noise. And then I'd lift the sweeping brushes up in the air and it looked like I was levitating, except it kind of didn't because you could see my actual legs.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's it. Yeah. So the legs were sticking, the sweeping brushes were sticking out the end of the sheet.
And then he'd start shouting at me, I can see your legs!
It was fucking brilliant. Amazing. I mean, that's the kind of shit though where you laugh, you just can't stop laughing.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was reminding me of your river dance. When I first saw you do river dance with the sheep mask on the back of your head and the tights and everything. I remember seeing that
was the original with the masks, yeah.
The original river dance.
Before Flatley did it. I remember seeing that in the attic. Upstairs in the White Horse.
It was the attic, the comedy
venue that was held up by two planks at the back. And I remember seeing that and thinking it was the most amazing thing I had ever seen. And I remember because it went on for so long and you were visibly knackered.
Yeah, because I didn't realise when I cut the music together how long. Like, it could have been 4 minutes, which is a long time.
Really long, and you can see how tired you were at the end of it. Sweat rolling down your face, and you can see that you were like, you know, just you were really just hammering it out until the end. It was brilliant. It was absolutely deadly. In fact, that was probably the funniest part of it, was that you were just like looking tired at you, going, "I'm going to get to the end if it kills me."
Yeah. Oh fucking hell! That was mad shit. You've heard about the time when the music didn't come on. That was the worst fucking time.
When the music didn't come on?
No, because I used to come up, I think I was in Brussels doing a gig, and I was emceeing, but the gig hadn't gone well for a few acts, so I thought, I'll finish it off at Riverdance, because the audience didn't seem to enjoy the whole show, right? So what, I go up and I take my shirt off and I have a little tiny t-shirt, it was like a six-year-old's t-shirt on, and drop my pants and I have tights on, and put on flippers and goggles, and then the music's meant to start, but the guy's going, the CD isn't working. So basically,
oh, Jesus,
I just have to walk off stage. Now, they think that's what my act was.
Was you just standing
just
there?
Me in gear. There in tights and flippers.
That's so amazing.
Good night.
Oh, Jesus.
Anyway.
I love when stuff like that goes wrong, though. Declan Rooney has probably the best one, where he walked on stage. St. Patrick's Day years ago. McSavage used to do these St. Patrick's Day things, and he walked on stage with a bucket on his head.
Yeah.
I don't know what the act was supposed to be, but he did, and of course Declan would be like, course. No, don't bother. Yeah. Why would you rehearse it? You'll kill the creativity of it.
And he
walked on stage with a bucket on his head, and then he realised at the start, it's a long way to the mic, and he couldn't find the microphone with the bucket on his head. So then he had to lift the bucket up to sort of look where he was going, and then he gets to the mic and he drops the bucket back down, and then he realises now I can hear him because there's a bucket blocking the microphone. So then he picks up the microphone and sticks it between his face and the bucket, and it goes and then he realises there's nothing he can do, so the bucket gang has to go. So now he's standing there with no plan, holding the bucket. I just love that.
Like, he's amazing.
Ah, he was brilliant. Yeah, he was absolutely amazing. I remember saying to him, would you not get gigs anywhere else? He's like, no, make them come to you. That's what you need to do. Because he would only play the Haveney Bridge.
Right.
He's there, make them come to you.
Yeah. Because he had, you know, he spent ages rehearsing all Michael Jackson's dances.
Yes.
And then he got a mask specially made. Like, he spent $3,000 or something on this. It fit, molded to fit his face.
Did he?
Oh, yeah. He had that for a while, and he rehearsed all the moves because he thought, I'll go on the road doing Michael Jackson, basically. A tribute act, but with his face.
With his actual head.
Yeah. And he got, apparently, he got someone from MCD or someone like that, like, to come and see this act. Like, he'd been rehearsing in a gym or whatever for ages. And a rehearsal room, and he got your man down. But he'd never done the whole routine with the mask on. And when he started sweating, he couldn't see anything. Again, it's the bucket thing again, in a way. But he danced into a wall. Fucking smacked himself off a wall and collapsed.
In front of an empty bucket.
And yeah, so it didn't happen. Anyway, he had that mask for years.
I love that. I love gigs that go wrong. No one gives a shit about your good gigs, really. You know what I mean?
There's something
brilliant about having an epic death. Like, I've had loads of epic deaths, and they're the only stories I care to tell about stand-up, really.
Yeah.
Like, I did a gig in Ernst & Young, you know, the accountants or whatever.
I've heard of them.
Anyway,
yeah.
I was in Dunboyne Castle. It was a huge, big, fancy affair, like proper big, fancy job. And I remember walking in and thinking, oh, I'm in trouble. I'm dead now. I'm not going to be able to pull this off.
The minute you saw the room.
The minute I saw the room. Like, huge, big circular tables, big floral things in each of them. And I was like, I'm in an awful state.
Mm.
And then the boss gets up and he starts cracking
jokes.
Corporate jokes.
Yeah.
I hope you're paying for this, you know. And they started laughing and thought, Jesus, you know something, there's a chance this actually might go well.
Right.
I think actually this will work.
Yeah.
And then he brought me on.
Ridiculous optimism, yeah.
Yeah, I know. Jesus. And then he brought me on and I think the first thing I did was a joke about the managing director being bald. It was the stupidest thing I could. It was literally suicide. Like.
Yeah.
And then I think I saw something about being a glue sniffer then. And then it was so quiet. And I mean, it was so quiet that if anybody laughed, it wrecked it. You know, that sort of
stuff.
And at one point, someone dropped a fork and like the front table ducked. That's how tense the room was. And I could hear an argument at the side of the stage. And I used to do stuff with music with my mate Pat.
Yeah.
And it's a woman who was talking to Pat going, give him the signal. Whatever signal you people use to say this isn't working.
He's like,
there's no signal, like, you know what I mean? And he walked onto the stage when I was on it and just go, you have to go. And the mic's live, so they're listening. Like, he's going, you have to go. They want you to go. And I was like, oh, Jesus, right? And then Pat just goes, we'll give them a song first. And we played a really stupid parody song that we used to love doing called The Eye of the Penis, which is like The Eye of the Tiger.
The Eye of the Penis.
And as soon as we finished, they charged at us. They jumped out of their seats and ran after us.
That is unbelievable.
Chased us into the car park, but it was brilliant. Just something amazing.
Something so satisfying.
That
is amazing. But to get checked, what were they going to do? Were they actually going to beat you?
No, they just wanted to roar at us,
They
roared at us in the car and they roared at us going out. They just wanted to let us know we ruined the night. They roared at us.
Jesus Christ. They ruined the night. Oh, it's terrible. The things you do, you say that when you do the wrong thing because you're a bit nervous. So you go, ah, this will work. So you slack off the managing director. Oh, do you know what I mean?
Jesus,
and I did a thing for Pat Kenny, his golf classic for charity or something. And it was a bit dodgy before I went on because I asked Simon, could I do a sound check? And he went, nope. And I went, well, I'm going on, like, I'm just doing a bit of comedy and I'm using the guitar. And he's going, no, you can't. No, this is Dickie Rock's sound system. He doesn't let anyone else use it. I'm like, well, I can't do the gig. Then I went, he goes, well, I don't care.
Not my problem, bud.
Not my problem. So I just go up to find Pat Kenny and go, oh, look, I can't do the gig because it's Dickie Rock.
Dickie Rock won't let me use his microphone?
Yeah. So he's going, hang on. So he calls whoever it is, not Dickie Rock, but Dickie Rock's right hand man. And it's cleared. Then he tells me, advice that Gay Byrne gave me. And this isn't Pat Kenny's voice, but anyway, he said, if it's not going great, just wrap it up, you know, just don't keep doing what you're meant to do. And I went, oh, yeah, okay. And so it's not going that great because they're all old geezers from, you know, old showbiz, Dickie Rock type friends.
Yeah,
and, you
it's
know,
just not the
and
audience.
Like, who's this? Like, it's not Sly Fox, you know. And but Pat Kenny stands up because obviously that is his signal to wrap it up and he's going to come on and do his thank you. But I just started slagging Pat Kenny. Just ripped into Pat Kenny and thinking, they love this. Oh my God, it was the stupidest decision ever.
And they just hate it died on your hole.
Yeah.
And then you're dying and you're making fun of the guy in the room actually want to hear talking.
Yeah, and the guy who hosts the Late Late Show. So my chances of getting the Late Late Show are fucking... I had done, I think, one or two before that, but I never did one again after that.
Jesus Christ. It's awful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just
and you can see and feel these things unravelling as you go. I mean, I remember doing a gig and all I had to do was just do my gig and die. That's all I had to do.
Yeah.
It was literally that simple. I was dying on my arse.
Yeah.
It was a corporate gig. All I had to do was have the decency to stand there and die for half an hour and go home, and no one would have given a shit. No one would have cared. And the guy stands in front of me and again, just ignore him. But I asked him, of course, I said, where are you from? Russia. And then I did the stupidest joke I could have done. If you don't sit down, I'll kick you in the Bolsheviks. And he got me in a headlock and threw me over his dinner table.
Fuck!
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Got me in a headlock and threw me over his dinner table.
It's a funny joke. Yeah. It's definitely not worth a headlock.
No, but then I think he kind of thought he was messing, though. It was he was friendly wrestling me.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Threw me over his dinner table. Nobody even noticed. I was just dying. Like, I had to do, I just stood up and walked out the door.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, but you're in fight or flight mode. You're in, like, you're full of adrenaline. Yeah. You're going to make bad decisions.
I know, yeah. You know, and I struggled with it for so long. And then, I don't know, I used to have the worst anxiety for stage fright, the shit I used to put myself through. I used to sit there and shake, and a couple of times I got sick, and it got worse. The longer I did stand up, the worse and worse it got, which was really ridiculous, like, when you think about it. And then I stopped doing stand up altogether for a couple of years, actually.
Would it start during the day before a gig? That morning.
Yeah, I'd wake up and I'd remember what I had to do that day, and then that was it. I was off.
So your whole day was ruined.
Whole day. Well, not ruined, but
slightly just there in the background.
In the background. And I'd be no good for conversation, no good talking to anyone. Yeah. Became very selfish and sort of self-absorbed. Like, you know, I wouldn't even hear what other people are saying to me.
Yeah.
Because I'm always just thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? When I get here, what if it's shit? What happens if this doesn't work? What happens? You know? Mm. And now I know, you go home, nothing happens. It actually doesn't even matter, you know? Because 90% of the time you're hitting it exactly the way you want to do it. But I don't know why I couldn't just get that into my head. I just couldn't get it into my head. I couldn't. And I genuinely, if I did a gig I didn't like, I would beat myself up over it for so long. God. I mean, I would really torture myself over it. Like, I convinced myself I was worthless. Yeah. I shouldn't have done it, and that you're not good at anything. It's the only thing you're supposed to do. The only thing you can do, and you're now, and you're fucking that up as well. I'd go into this, like, despair after a bad gig. Real despair. Like, horrible. Yeah. So then the idea of going to a gig and putting myself in that headspace again was terrifying. It was terrifying.
And that was all through, like, when you were, you know, straight after, say, Naked Camera, you were huge, right? And you were doing massive venues, correct?
Yeah, went almost immediately, yeah. And because that's when people actually watched television. So, like, a bad show now, or a bad show then, would still be what considered a ratings hit now, because there was no TV on demand, there was no Netflix, you know, so people actually sat in and watched the telly.
So
when you got on TV then, you had a genuine chance of doing bigger tours and stuff, where it's much harder for people now, you know?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Much harder.
Netflix and all that kind of stuff. So, but you were catapulted then. So you say you were, before Naked Camera, what kind of stuff, what were you doing? Were you doing stand-up, right? Of course you were.
Nearly 10 years,
You were for ages, yeah. And even then you were nervous about doing that, right?
Yeah, nervous about doing that.
Doing,
but not as bad.
Yeah,
but nervous, yeah. And then, I suppose there was no expectation. I didn't feel like I had to get it right.
Did it increase then with bigger venue?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, much worse. All of a sudden there was something to lose. There was nothing to lose before.
Yeah.
I was still being a motorbike courier between it when I had to, or getting factory jobs when I had to.
Yeah.
Doing me bits and pieces between stand-up. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it felt like it was real. It became a real job. And then there was people to be disappointing, you know. For the first time ever, your name was on the door and people were depending on you to make their weekend worthwhile or their night worthwhile. And the pressure of it was...
When you were actually on stage performing, did you feel it? Or was that okay?
No, always.
Even on stage?
Yeah. I'd rattle through my set as fast as possible just to get to the end of it. Just to get to the end.
Yeah.
And then you'd walk off, and immediately if it went well, walk off, there was that great feeling you get, you know. But it was as much a feeling as got away with it as it was that was great crack.
Mm.
It was as much of that. It was like after you need it, big piss, and then suddenly you've just got to let it out. It was that as well. But it was I don't know why I let myself get into such a ball of shit with the whole thing, because it should have been, and it was, a really enjoyable time. It really was, like, you know, I suppose, I don't know, you probably feel like you don't deserve it. You probably feel like you're going to get found out, you know. You feel like someone's going to say, no, we know what you're up to now, and then that's it, the game is up,
right? Yeah.
And you're trying to make the most out of a situation, because you know, it's because I'm very, very lucky, and I suppose it just felt more like luck than anything else. It didn't really feel like anything. Only look.
But how did Naked Camera come about? Because I know that Naked Camera, the idea was knocking around for a while, and a few people were involved in that, and they left. It didn't work. Blah blah. I know Patrick McDonald then became involved.
Yeah, but Liam McGrath, a guy called Liam McGrath. Yeah, he's a documentary maker, and he was doing primetime stuff. And he was doing stuff on Gangland, Dublin Gangland, and he bought all this covert filming gear. And a Dublin gangster pulled a gun on him, and he just had a new kid and all. He was like, oh, look, I'm not doing this shit. So he started going to comedy clubs. He had this idea that he'd make like a new Mike Murphy's Live Mic type kid and camera comedy show. And at that time, there hadn't been one in a long time. And he asked loads of people like that. He asked loads of people, but they all backed out for different reasons. I think some of the lads got shows in the West End, and then Dave McSavage was involved, and he just lost his patience with it. And Patrick stayed on, and then I think Patrick recommended me, but I was literally the last person they called. Like, they didn't, there was no enthusiasm for me.
And
I turned it down. I said, no, I'm going. I had enough of stand-up. I turned it down. Went off on a bike trip and came back and says, I don't suppose you're still looking for someone. And they said, yeah, come out and we'll do a day. And then my first day was the first sketch they showed.
What was it?
It was, we met in Phibsborough with no idea of what to do. I says, give us a, if we can get a photocopied bag of cash, and I'll go in and try and buy things with it. That was the only idea that we had. And lucky I have a bit of a knacker's head. So we thought we'd pull it off, you know. So I had this like sort of the old jumper you used to see the lads wearing years ago, you know, the old hard shots. And because I was so nervous, I was shaking, so I looked apart. And then the first thing we did was walk into a real estate agent's across the road and try and buy a house for cash.
And that's the first,
and that was the first
and
one.
It worked straight off,
and it worked straight away. Just got really lucky. Just got really lucky. The whole thing was luck, really.
And did you enjoy doing that? Or is that nervous as well? Were you nervous about that as well?
Very nervous, but I loved it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it every day. I loved doing it. Even though I was shitting myself. But I don't mind shitting myself a lot of the time. I sort of draw myself. Well, I tend to go towards.
You fucking do motorbike racing, so you must
be a bit of adrenaline. But yeah, I do love it. Like, I don't mind giving myself rights, you know. You feel alive when you let the devil bite your arse, you know. And then, so I was terrified, but I loved it. I would have done it forever, you know. But then, like anything else, the energy runs out of it, you know. And then we did it for too long. Like, we went and we did the show Making Jake over in the States, and it was just a bad TV show. Because we took out the main character. The main character in Naked Camera was Dublin. It was Dublin City.
I suppose, yeah.
And you get rid of the main character, then
yeah,
it's just a crappy spin-off. And that's all it was a crappy spin-off. And
how did it work then with the sketch show? What was that sketch show you did? Well, it was all you. It wasn't, it was characters. It was all
Meet the Neighbours.
Meet the Neighbours, yeah. Yeah, and I did kind of an audition for that, was it?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I did a couple of characters for it, but... that was really good. Conan O'Brien was really into this.
I don't know. That's in Wikipedia. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's true. I think someone just wrote
that.
I have the clue. It wasn't me anyway.
Right, okay.
But I don't know where that came from. I really don't know.
Well, it sounds good.
I've never seen it anywhere with that Wikipedia page.
Really?
And I've Googled it and there's no trace of it. So I don't think it's a real quote. Okay. I don't think it's a real quote. But to be honest, I think that's the thing I enjoyed the most. That when we did Meet the Neighbours... I think it's the best thing I ever worked on. But nobody watched it, unfortunately.
Really?
It was my fault. I dug my heels in and I made a stupid mistake. I wanted to get something on RT1. I don't know why I had it in my head. I just had more viewers and it'd be a sort of a step up in the world. I don't know why I had this in my head. It was just a bad call. And I remember having it out with RTE kind of and saying, no, I really wanted to be on RT1. I really wanted to be... I suppose I was looking at the likes of Kilna Scully and seeing the audience figures and how big a show it was. And that's where you want to be. And then
it's definitely more conservative, RT1.
Definitely more conservative. And it was 2007. So the world was falling down. Or 2008. The world was falling down. And we were on right after primetime.
Not a good thing. It wouldn't be the right slot, would it?
Yeah. And they told me this. Everybody told me this. This is not the right thing for this show. But I argued and fought, and it was a stupid move on my part. It was a stupid
bizarre
move.
It's bizarre that it is so effect it does affect it, what channel and what. Well, of course.
But maybe course that, maybe does, people just didn't like it as well. There's also the fact that people like that the viewership did go down every week. So maybe people saw it and it just didn't capture the imagination in the same way too. All I know is it's the favorite, my favorite thing that I've done. But I don't know. Maybe just not a. Maybe it's actually not a good show.
It's got good. It got great reviews. I really liked it. And yeah, I like character stuff as well.
Yeah,
like,
same here. Yeah, it got good reviews.
And,
yeah.
What was I going to say there? But now would that change now? Would it be more people watching it on the player? Would it make a difference now? As much. Whether it's on a different channel because people can just go on the player.
I don't think so. I actually feel sorry for young stand-ups now because the traditional routes are sort of shot to shit. They're gone. Like, I think if you went onto RT now, either channel, I don't think it matters because no one's sitting in watching terrestrial telly. People are recording or it's
unless
like
the, it's something like a live event, like a football match or the centenary celebration.
Yeah, or something really captures the imagination. Like it's Mrs. Brown or it's Love Hate and people are stuck in watching. But generally, terrestrial telly is just the, like it's less than half of what it used to be.
Is it? Yeah, Jesus.
So you get like so, and then you're so much more competition now as well. And you just think, how I don't know.
And yet, at the same time, you would say like American TV is taking over from film. I mean, people are obsessed with Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul. Or,
yeah, but I think that's where it's at, though. I think that the days of regular terrestrial TV is dead. You have to be blockbuster stuff. It has to be House of Cards or Orange is the New Black or Netflix's own home thing, Better Call Saul. Or but the days of people sitting in and seeing lads hanging around the panel show, for example.
No, that won't happen. No.
It's just not. It's never going to have the audience it used to have. Yeah. It just never will. It'll still have an audience, but the size of that, like something like the panel, is never going to happen again, you know? I don't think it is.
Even
anyway.
The panel shows.
I don't think so.
Well, I think Cats is huge, isn't it? And all that kind of malarkey. I don't know.
Yeah, but I'd be willing to put money on it that even in England, the same is happening, that people just aren't watching it in the same numbers they used to.
Right, yeah. It's funny, I was talking to somebody who, I think they worked in a shop that sold DVDs, and he said the people who buy DVDs are all mental now. They're people who don't go online, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're just all mental.
And who doesn't go online? Like, even perverts are online.
Yeah,
who doesn't go online? You have to be really weird to not be online.
I know. It's bizarre. So, like, now you're doing radio, and how's that working?
Yeah, it's again, do you know what was great about it? It's like,
before we go on, how did you get over the whole nervous thing?
We did a documentary.
I know you did a documentary, but how, what?
And what happened was basically, I didn't work for 2 years, so I had to go back to stand up. That was just the end of it because I had no money.
I had to go
back to stand up. I wrote a show, and then I remember being approached by Al, who I was writing the show with, and he's saying, would you do a documentary on getting back in and trying to get over your nerves? And straight away I was like, yeah, if you want to do it, we'll do it, but let's be realistic here. I'm never going to get over this, so it's probably not going to have an ending and all of this sort of happened. And then I got totally, really bad anxiety about what way the show was going to look, the TV show, and I just got tied in knots over it. But it started this process, this genuine process where I had to ask myself every day, why are you freaking out all the time? Why are you losing your mind every time you go to work? What's wrong with you? And I think that was the main thing. So I went to do like this NLP stuff, which was grand. And I met this other...
Was that NLP?
This neuro-linguistic programming
stuff. Right,
and I don't know if that worked or not. I don't know. I don't think any one thing that we did worked. We tried all this different stuff. And we met this other professor of stage fright guy. I can't remember his name. He's a Dutch guy. He's a really nice guy, really good crack. And I did some exercises with him where it's like you pretend there's a tape recorder in your head and you record yourself saying positive things to you and trying to raise the negative sort of things you say to yourself. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but I do remember that I was at a gig and I was asking myself different questions. So I stopped going, what if this is shit? And started saying, what if this is the best one I ever do?
Yeah?
Yeah. What if this is tonight is the best gig I've ever done? Or what?
Right.
How are you going to feel now if this is brilliant? So my internal dialogue started to change.
Internal dialogue. Wow.
It started to change.
That's amazing.
And the fear then was gone.
I have that. Shite internal dialogue of self-criticism.
Yeah, and I remember talking to Dave McSavage, and he said to me, and it was a good point, is like, if anybody else in the world spoke to you that way, you'd just tell them to fuck off.
Yeah.
You'd walk away. Yeah. But you'll do it to yourself all day long.
Yeah.
All day, you'll do it to yourself.
I mean, it's crazy.
It is crazy,
if I got turned down or I was up for something and I didn't get it, straight away I'm going, you're not good enough. Look, you're always getting turned down. You're like,
yeah, the same thing.
And it's part of this job is getting turned down.
Rejection and getting turned down and doing stuff you believed in and realising it's not good. And
that's
part of the gig. In fact, that's most of the gig.
Yeah, yeah.
That's most of the gig.
Yeah, because even when you're writing new material, in my experience, at least half, probably over half of the stuff that you write won't work.
Yeah. And then even the stuff that does work doesn't work at the start.
So yeah, you have to
die in
the
hole with new stuff.
Mm. So it was just basically you changing your whatever you were saying
my
to yourself.
My internal dialogue, yeah. I started talking to myself differently, yeah.
That's amazing. And did it work immediately or...?
Almost immediately.
Really?
Yeah, almost immediately. After years.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Almost immediately.
That's brilliant.
Oh, God, I think I'm going to get sick. Oh.
Oh, it's hungover.
Yeah.
Sorry, we'll wrap it up now. Okay.
But
do you want to get sick?
I think I have to.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious, yeah.
Oh, shit. Okay. Well,
I'll come back into you, will I? Is there a toilet?
There is one downstairs. No, I think we'll wrap it up because we've only got 3 minutes left.
Okay.
So just go and get sick. And on that bombshell, I know. But seriously, thanks for coming in. I didn't realise you were that fucking sick.
I needed to lie until like in this last minute.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. Don't be sorry. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
I wish I could go down and record you getting sick.
I think I'll have to go really fast. Where is it
downstairs? Oh, yeah, sorry, I'll show you. Well, I've just... PJ's just gone off to get sick. Thanks. Well, that was an unusual end to a podcast, an interview. But PJ had been out the night before being patriotic, celebrating the 1916 centenary. So only right that he did that for Ireland. It was for Ireland he did it. But he wouldn't have felt half as bad if he had been drinking a nice craft beer like Jack Cody's, which I'm drinking now. I'm drinking Jack Cody's Smiggy, which is now my favourite lager, or ale, I should say. It's amber ale from Drogheda, rich biscuit, malt base, topped with floral American hops. An excellent accompaniment with food. It's delicious. And Jack Cody will be providing free drinks to the first 30 people who arrive at the live podcast next 27th of April downstairs in the Stag's Head. We already have Kevin Gildee confirmed, a couple of guys from the Improv, the Dublin Comedy Improv, and a surprise guest, which I cannot reveal at the moment because he or she will be performing their own show. And we don't want to interfere with ticket sales, do we? Because it's donation into the podcast and you get a free beer for the first 30 people. So come along if you like the podcast. If it's your first time listening, go back and have a listen to there's about 40, over 40 other interviews with people like Ardla Handlin, Frank Kelly, Brezzy, Catherine Lynch, all sorts of people. Culture Reardon from the Pogues, Mundy. Yeah, just great, great backlog there, and back catalogue, I should say. And if you are the first time here on the podcast, please give us a review as well on iTunes and a star rating. Thank you to Castaway Media for hosting the podcast. Thank you to Andrew Mangan for producing, for Daniel Rooney for the music. And thank you, PJ Gallagher, for being a guest. And thank you for tuning in. And thank Jack Cody for providing the beer.
I'll see you next week, and I'll be talking to... Oh, I can't remember who I'm talking to. Oh, yeah, someone very interesting. I'll see you next week. Goodbye!
This was a Castaway Media production. Find more great podcasts on our network. Visit castaway.media.